And we are now under the recording. Okay, so our topic for tonight, colonial Jewish communities. So if last week we began our series on American Jewish history with the discussion of Peter Stuyvesant and New Amsterdam, so today we'll branch out beyond New Amsterdam / New York and examine the other parts of the colonies, the would-be United States, where Jews tend to settle. But just to recapitulate for those who might have missed last week, so Jews arrive in New Amsterdam in 1654, and the place is not very hospitable because of Stuyvesant, but Jews are allowed to stay. Those were not the first Jews in the New World. There had been Jews in the New World already from the days of Columbus, and there had been stray Jews here and there throughout the 1500s and early 1600s in other colonies, but they did not settle down and strike roots and establish any kind of community. The New Amsterdam group was the first large, if you could call it that, 23 people large group that was able to create a kehilah, so to speak, a community. And at first they were not allowed to have public worship. They were forced to worship privately, but by 1695, there was a synagogue on Beaver Street downtown in Manhattan, and by the year 1700, it was already a municipal landmark. People knew that's the synagogue. It was rented quarters. It was not a synagogue building just yet, but everyone knew that's where the Jews pray. The Sherith Israel congregation board minutes are extant ever since 1729, with reference to documents as early as 1706. So they were around for a very long time. The Mill Street building, which was the first building constructed for the purpose of being a synagogue, was put up in 1730. So the Jews of New York are growing. They're still fairly small. They're divided between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, with Ashkenazim at this point now outnumbering the Sephardim, but still the Sephardic rite being the dominant one liturgically. And that is the original community. But they're not the only one. So let's now go to some other parts of the country where Jews settled. Let's go to Rhode Island, because Rhode Island was a place that could be a welcome home, a comfortable rest stop for people of divergent religious views, because Roger Williams, the founder of the First Baptist Church of America, he believes in religious tolerance. So in the late 1600s, Jews moved to Rhode Island knowing that they will not have trouble and not suffer on account of their religious difference, because this is a tolerant location. It's possible that we're not 100% sure, but that these Jews who went to Rhode Island came from Recife, Brazil, escaped the Portuguese conquest, just as had the Jews who went to New Amsterdam, but that they went not to Cuba and then New York, but rather Suriname, Barbados, and Bermuda, and then eventually made their way to Rhode Island. They were making their way northbound. They purchased a cemetery plot in 1677, which is not surprising that even before there is a synagogue, there's a cemetery, because you don't have to daven, but everybody dies. So you need to have a cemetery, and nobody wants, who's a traditional Jew, wants to be in a situation where they unexpectedly face their maker and their earthly remains are without a sanctified ground in which to be interred. So buying a cemetery plot is a big deal. The community of Newport disbanded in the early 1700s because there just wasn't enough of a Jewish presence there. People moved away for economic reasons. And if you don't have a critical mass, if you don't have a quorum to daven with a minyan, or you don't have the communal infrastructure, it all comes crashing down. But it was revived in the 1740s, and a congregation was reestablished. What is the name of this congregation in Newport? Does anybody know?
Zero.
What's the name of the Newport congregation?
Zero.
The synagogue is Turo.
It's called the Turo Synagogue, but the Hebrew original Jewish name.
Mikveh Israel.
We're going to get to Mikveh Israel. Wrong city, but okay. So
Sherith Israel.
No, not Sherith Israel. That's New York. Okay, so it was originally called Nefutzei Yisrael.
Oh,
the ones of Israel. Later, they changed their name to Yeshuat Yisrael, the salvation of Israel. Why they changed the name will be an interesting piece of the discussion in a few minutes. But the synagogue was first put under construction in 1759 and was dedicated in 1763. Unlike some of the old buildings of synagogues from the 18th century and early 19th century that were eventually knocked down to make way for better structures later on, this, what became known as the Turo Synagogue, still stands. So that building has been around for 257 years. It's in good shape today. It's been restored, and it's a nice tourist attraction. So the Newport community was a good, solid community of traditional Jews that had their synagogue, that had their cemetery, and, as we shall see, even had an influence over certain Christian theologians of renown in the colonial period. Let's go to other parts of New England. Massachusetts. Massachusetts was not known as being a friendly place for people who were religious dissenters. And in fact, Boston was the last of the major colonial-era American cities to have any significant Jewish population. But why? So the conventional answer is that there was religious intolerance by the Puritans, who were fanatical in their beliefs. But there's also another possibly overriding factor, and that was the lack of economic opportunity. For whatever reason, the economic situation in Boston and in Massachusetts more generally was not conducive for a Jewish presence. Now, there was a very famous Jew in the colonial period who lived in Massachusetts, and his name was Judah Monis. That name might ring a bell to some of you, because Monis was a Meshumad. He converted out of the faith. He became a Protestant. And why did he become a Protestant? For Parnassah, okay? Usually when a Jew becomes a Protestant, it's for some reason other than theological conviction. So what was the Parnassah? He was given the job as chair of the Hebrew department at Harvard. Harvard is in 1636, already it's the oldest college in the United States, and it's a prestigious institution, and they need someone to teach Hebrew. Why Hebrew? Well, you got to learn the Old Testament, you know? Someone's got to be able to read the Bible in the original. So, Monis was a scholar, and he taught Bible and Hebraic literature at Harvard for 41 years, from 1722 to 1763. But had he not apostatized, there was no way he could be hired. He had to become a Christian in order to receive that job. Okay, now the Puritans, in general, were intolerant, but especially of three categories of people. One are Turks. What's wrong with Turks? What are Turks?
Muslims,
good. Mohammedans, Muslims, as they would call them back then.
Muslim.
Right? Often spelled M-U-S-S-E-L-M-A-N. You won't see that anymore. But Turks were did exist in some small number. I don't necessarily think they were from Turkey, but they were practicing Muslims in the colonial period in a very small number. The second category are Jews. And the third are Papists. What are Papists?
Catholics.
Good. Catholics. Followers of the Pope. So as far as the Puritans are concerned, the Turks, the Jews, and the Papists are like the devil. And they shouldn't be allowed in our province. We don't want them. The earliest record of a Jew being physically present in the colony of Massachusetts was that of Solomon Franco in 1649. So that, notice, this is before 1644 when the Jews come to New Amsterdam. This is 5 years earlier. So he's in Massachusetts in 1649 on business, you know, part of the reasons. And the only reason we know that he was there is because he was issued a court order to leave. So the first reference to Jew in Massachusetts is get out. Okay. Cotton Mather, who was an important figure, a theologian in American colonial history, wanted to convert the Jews en masse to the Puritan faith. So if you have theologians like that running around the colony, it's clear that Jews, and certainly practicing Jews, will not find a welcome home in that location. Now, what other New England colony also had a strong Puritan presence and therefore was inhospitable to Jews? Which one?
New Hampshire.
So New Hampshire, to an extent, yes, but they were kind of out of the way, and Jews weren't going there anyway. So New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont have no organized Jewish community prior to 1800. Yes, there was a stray Jew here and there in all three colonies. However, there is absolutely no synagogue, no community, no burial ground, nothing before 1800. The colony I had in mind was Connecticut. Connecticut had strict Puritan blue laws. Okay, if you were doing commerce on Sunday, oy vavoy, bad news for you. And Jews have to do commerce on Sunday because they can't do it on Shabbos. So Connecticut was not a friendly place during the colonial period. We find basically no Jews there in the late 1600s and even in the early 1700s. It's not until towards the middle to late 18th century that we finally find a Jewish community in Norwalk, Connecticut, of all places, Norwalk, because the Jews found some work.
How did it start?
Shipping. Okay.
How long is it?
The next colony I want to mention is one that has a bad reputation, but undeservedly so. Undeservedly so. And that's Georgia. What do people tend to think about Georgia? What do they call it? Anybody know? What do people call Georgia?
Peach State.
The Peach State.
Prisoners.
Right, prisoners. Bingo. Good, good. Is that Paul? Ah, okay. So it's known as like a penal colony. Prisoners.
Prisoners.
But it's not really true. It's a little bit true, but not entirely true. It's an unfair knock on Georgia. The truth of the matter is that Georgia was established by James Oglethorpe as a way of bringing impoverished Britons to the New World where they could have a new life where they would be able to escape their debts. Now, yes, if there were some from debtor's prison who might have gone to Georgia, but these were not like convicts, like murderers and rapists and scoundrels. These were people who really just were suffering to make a go of it financially in the old country and wanted a new lease on life. And Georgia presented that opportunity where they'd be given a homestead, they'd be given some parcel of land to till the soil, and life could be good for them, whereas it wasn't going to be good back home. Okay, with that in mind, this all began in 1732. At first, there was a desire to keep Jews out. Why? Not for religious reasons. This is very interesting. Jews were not excluded here for religious reasons, but rather because historically, Jews were not tillers of the soil.
Yeah.
Jews do for a living? Trade.
Power.
Lending. Secondhand goods. Whatever it is. Jews were not planting crops. They were not agriculturalists in the old country of Europe. So since this was going to be an agricultural colony, and Jews don't do that, what is it assumed that they're going to do? They're going to be a bunch of leeches and living off of everybody else's hard work. So therefore, keep the Jews out because they're not tillers of the soil. They don't belong here. Another reason why at first some wanted to keep the Jews out of Georgia was because the Jews were Sephardim in large number, and they spoke Spanish. And who controls Florida? The Spanish. Feared that the Sephardic Jews would be in cahoots with the Spanish and would converse with them in the language that the British didn't understand and would thus be guilty of some kind of treason against the colony. So those were two theories why Jews ought not to be allowed into Georgia. But what actually happened? So 42 Jews arrived in 1733, shortly after the colony was established. And Oglethorpe welcomed them in. Why did he do so? He overruled whatever other objections there might have been. The reason is because he understood you need population. Population, population, population. If you have a colony with an insufficient number of people, it's going to flounder and die. It needs to grow in size. So we need these people. Jews, heathens, be damned. It doesn't matter. Let them in. Let them in. Okay. So the third synagogue in America to be established was Mikveh Israel. Israel in Savannah.
Yeah.
1735. Who were these Jews that went to Savannah? Why are they going there? The answer is Jews are people too. You know that? Jews are people too. And just as the Christians do, so too the Jews do. If the Christians need to send off the impoverished Britons from the British Isles off to the New World to give them a lease on life because there's no Parnassa for them back home. Well, the Jews do the same thing. The London Jewish community had grown substantially between the days of Menashe ben Israel in 1654 and the 1730s. There were now over 6,000 Jews in London, and some of them are desperately poor. And the Kehillah, the synagogue, the Bevis Marks synagogue, which is the chief Sephardic synagogue, has to provide tzedakah for these people. Well, there's only so much tzedakah you want to find. Eventually, what do you do with your poor people? You ship them off to the other shul, you know? When in the neighborhood, when the schnorrer comes to one shul, you give them the $20, you give them whatever, $100, and you say the young Israel's down that way, or, you know, the Bethel is that way, or you say, you point to the other shul. So that's what the Bevis Marks did. They realized we can send off our impoverished Jews to the New World, just like the Goyim are going, and so they'll go. They'll go to Georgia, and they went to Savannah. Okay. Well, they went on a ship called the William and Sarah. There were 34 Sephardim and 8 Ashkenazim. So mostly Sephardic Ashkenazic families. And by the way, what were the Ashkenazim doing in London to begin with? You know, what were Ashkenazim are leaving London together with mostly Sephardim to go to Georgia. I understand why there were Sephardim in London who were escaping the Inquisition, the Spanish-Portuguese environment, and get Amsterdam, go to London. But why are there Ashkenazim in London? The answer is because the Ukrainian massacres, the Khmelnytsky massacres, did result in some Jews moving far westward, away from Eastern Europe, across Central Europe, making it as far as London, and then potentially even further, going off to the New World. Okay. So, what happens when they get there? They arrive on July 11th, my birthday, 1733. The state charter did not ban them. The state charter banned Catholics and slaves, not Jews. Why did the state charter ban slaves?
They wanted people to work the land.
Good, bingo. They wanted the white settlers to actually have real work with their bare hands. They didn't want, at least not yet, an environment where the African slave is doing all the work, but rather that would come eventually. I mean, Georgia would eventually be a major slave state, but not at the beginning. Why ban Catholics? Well, you know, it was a riot against Catholics in England. Okay, so the Jews have to prove their worth. The Jews have to prove that we are going to contribute to this colony. Well, they do right away. Dr. Samuel Nunes, one of the Sephardic Jews on the boat, he arrives in Savannah, and there's an outbreak of yellow fever. And he, the good doctor, mixes the potions and the herbs and the spices, and he saves people from yellow fever. And because of that, at his Hakara Satov, Oglethorpe and the others in the leadership of the Georgia colony are now favorably disposed towards Jews. Okay. But what happens? Very soon, after the community in Savannah purchases land for a cemetery and builds a mikveh. They built a mikveh. Very shortly after that happens, a lot of them run away. They run for the hills. What happened? Well, the answer is there was a war. The War of Jenkins' Ear. You never heard of this. The War of Jenkins' Ear. Ear. Look it up on Wikipedia. It's pretty gross why they call it the War of Jenkins' Ear. But it was part of the War of Spanish Succession. It was a British-Spanish conflict in which the Spaniards are moving northward from Florida and are threatening the colony of Georgia. Well, if you're a Sephardic Jew and it's 1742 and the Spaniards are coming, what are you going to do? You're going to run. You're going to run, because you know about that Inquisition and you don't want to be a part of it anymore. So where are you going to go? Well, you're going to go to Charleston. You're going to go to South Carolina, which is right over the border. Maybe you'll go further north if you're really scared and you want to run pretty far. But a lot of Jews from Savannah went to Charleston. Who didn't leave? Interestingly, the Ashkenazim didn't leave. Mm-hmm. So it's, this reminds me a little bit of the 1930s in the show, and the precursor to the Shoah, where the people with experience of anti-Semitism, they know to run. The people who didn't experience anti-Semitism, they stayed behind. As it turned out, it was fine. Nothing bad happened. Georgia was not overtaken by the Spaniards. but it's very fascinating that the Ashkenazim stayed and the Sephardim left. Okay, so because the critical mass of the community was gone, the synagogue didn't function, and Mikveh Israel of Savannah basically shut down or was dormant until the critical mass returned. And in 1774, just 2 years before the revolution, the shul was functioning again in Savannah in Georgia, which means let's bring us now to South Carolina.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
If I can just throw my two cents worth in on a little trivia information. I'm sorry?
Yeah, sure.
On a little trivia information on the Savannah shul. Uh-huh. If anybody's ever to go there, there's actually a copy of a letter written by George Washington to the children of Abraham that's posted on the side of the building, noting how, you know, he respects the Jews and wishes them kind of all the best. So just a little bit of interest for those of us who are somewhat historically oriented.
So we're going to discuss at length George Washington's letters to the Jews. There wasn't one. There were more than one. The famous one is to Newport, but there was one to Savannah, and I believe there was also one to Richmond. Okay.
Ah, I didn't know that. Okay.
Now, South Carolina. Richmond, I believe, the third one.
So okay.
In 1669, there was a charter for the Carolinas that was drafted by John Locke, the famous philosopher, political philosopher. And this charter for the Carolinas granted liberty of conscience to all settlers. That's a wonderful thing. Very nice. And expressly noted three categories of people: Jews, heathens, and dissenters. So Jews, I know, we're Jews. Who are heathens? Well, presumably it means agnostics and atheists. Who are dissenters? People who assert that they are Christian, but are of the wrong variety of Christian. So, you know, if you're the majority branch of whatever Protestant denomination, then you're in the mainstream. And if you're anything else, you're a dissenter. Okay. The first record of a Jew in South Carolina was 1695. Kahal Kadosh Beit Elohim was established in 1749. So it took them a while before a synagogue was established. But having done so, they were quite successful. They benefited from the mass exodus from Savannah, from Georgia, and that's why in the 1740s they had sufficient numbers to create a shul. It was the largest Jewish community in America during the late colonial and early Republican periods. So Charleston was the major community from about the 1760s through basically the 18-teens. They were the biggest community. South Carolina was also the first state to allow Jews to be elected to public office. Francis Salvador, obviously a Sephardic Jew, was elected as a freeholder of some kind in 1774. So at a time when in most other colonies and soon to be states, there were still religious disabilities against Jews in terms of holding public office, South Carolina was the first. Let's now go to where things weren't so friendly. Maryland. No. Story with Maryland. Maryland was established as what kind of a colony? Does anybody know?
Catholics.
Bingo, Catholic. It was established as a haven for British Catholic dissenters. In other words, when the Anglican Church comes into existence, the Anglican Church is like Catholicism without the Pope, in the sense that it has a pomp and circumstance, and it's got a lot of tchotchkes. So the Puritans believe that Anglicanism was insufficiently present, whereas the Catholics thought that the Anglican Church was insufficiently Catholic, and that you have to devotion to the papacy in Rome. So British Catholics wanted to get out of England, and they ran away. They went to Maryland. The problem that they had was when Catholicism suffered a major setback back in London in terms of the monarchy, that the monarchy was then entrenched in Anglicanism again. So the Anglican Church took over Maryland, and it was no longer so hospitable to Catholics. So de facto, the majority religion was Catholic, but de jure, it was really Anglican. But it was inhospitable to everybody else. And this would not change until 1776. And when I say 1776, I don't mean because that's the day of the revolution and the Declaration of Independence. Nothing to do with that. It's because it happens to be in 1776, the Maryland State Constitution was drafted, or rather was amended. And that constitution granted political freedom and equality for all professing denominations of Christians. So if you were now a Protestant or a Catholic dissenter, you were in the clear. Who is not included? Jews. So what about the Jews? It's not fair. There weren't that many Jews in Maryland. There was no congregation. There was no synagogue. Certainly not yet. Not until in Baltimore in the early decades of the 1800s. And then later in Annapolis. But what about the Jews? So does anybody care about the Jews other than the Jews themselves? Do the Jews have friends outside of our own fold?
Yeah, evangelical Christians.
Evangelical Christians. So in this instance, it was not an evangelical, it was a Catholic. That a state representative in the state house by the name of Thomas Kennedy, I don't think any relation to JFK, because their family didn't come to America until significantly later, but Thomas Kennedy, who was an Irish Catholic representative, championed the cause of the Jews, and in 1826, there was the Maryland Jew Bill. And the Maryland Jew Bill meant that when you wanted to run for office, and for that matter, take the oath of office, you no longer had to swear an oath on the good faith of a Christian, which meant that you could be a Jew and just swear a sort of a bland, religiously neutral oath on whatever Bible or non-Bible you wanted. Okay, let's go to Pennsylvania. I see there are a few questions in the chat. I'll get to them eventually. There was a question, did people keep kosher, how strictly? And I'm going to get to that. Were there rabbis? The answer is no. Okay, so I'll just mention that for a moment right now. There were no rabbis in mainland North America who settled permanently or ran congregations until 1840, which is pretty late in the game. Jews come in 1654. The first rabbi is Abraham Rice in Baltimore in 1840. So for almost 190 years, this is nobody. There was one rabbi, we'll talk about him shortly, Chaim Yitzchak Karigal, who was an itinerant preacher who made the rounds in the cities in the 1770s just to raise money for Eretz Yisrael. But there were rabbis in the Caribbean. So in Barbados, in Bermuda, in Jamaica, there were real ordained rabbis, but not in mainland North America, which led to a problem of how do you handle certain types of complicated religious matters that require the good offices of the clergy. So the answer is that for divorces, for gittin, they would have to send it off to a rabbi out of the country, whether in the Caribbean or in London. So the chief rabbi of London, of England, would play a role in answering the she'elot and giving the teshuvot for the Jews of North America, including some very interesting questions about slaveholding, but it's not for now. As for kashrus, so kosher meat was available if you lived near the major community, because there were shochtim in the various kihilot. But if you lived far away, if you lived out in the boondocks, and you were not a shochet, how did you have meat? Well, the answer is you didn't, or you ate treif. So it was incumbent upon the kihilah, where there was a synagogue community, to make sure that there are a sufficient number of shochtim, and that there's oversight. These guys are not charlatans and not doing a scam job on everybody, because that's a real problem. How do you know if he's doing a good job? If you don't know the rules, and only he claims to know the rules, it could be a farce. So, but the purveying of kosher meat was a way for the kihilah to make some revenue and to keep people close together, because they needed their butcher. Okay, so let's go to Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, Jews were there as early as William Penn's arrival in 1682. The Quakers, the Friends, were very tolerant. They did not push around religious dissenters. They were very tolerant. Congregation Mikveh Israel, same name as the one in Savannah, was established in 1745, but was not dedicated until 35 years later in 1782, actually during the, well, right at the end of the Revolutionary War. There was a Jewish presence inland in Pennsylvania, as far as Lancaster, already in the 1740s. But why in Lancaster? Because there are roads, toll roads, there's commerce towards the hinterlands, and Jews tend to go towards the hinterlands because they can do trading. Okay. Well, what about Virginia? Virginia was not the friendliest of places as far as Jews are concerned, but Jews did settle in Richmond in 1769. Kahal Kadosh Beit Shalom was established 20 years later in 1789, and by 1790, it was the fourth largest Jewish community behind Charleston, New York, and Philly. So Virginia got a late start, but then became very prominent. The Richmond community was a very important community in the early Republican period, in the Jacksonian period. And it had the important Jews there, Isaac Leeser, who becomes the leader of the traditionalist Jews fighting off the Reform in the middle of the 19th century. Okay. Now, the major Jewish concern in all these places was economic freedom, and commercial opportunity, the right to trade. As for the right for public worship, it's important. Granted, it's important, but it's not that important. Why is it not so important? Because, first of all, if you don't daven, you don't daven. Secondly, if you daven, you can do it privately. Okay, you can either be yachid, you know, without a minion, or with a minion, but without calling attention to that minion. You know, in the private home, in the rented quarters, you don't need to build a building that has a big Jewish star on it and says Hebrew lettering on the facade. If you have to do without that, you do without that. And so the Jews in the various colonies were much more interested in, can I make parnasa than can I have my Kahal Kadosh in bold letters on the facade of the building? Okay, what about formal rights? There's a question about the total number of Jews in the colonies, and the answer is, at the time of the revolution in 1776, we assume it was between 2,500 and 3,000. In 1700, it's probably about 500, and in 1720, probably about 1,500 and thereabouts. It kept growing to between 2,500 and 3,000 in the 1770s. Okay, so the Plantation Act of 1740 was an act of Parliament. The British Parliament, in which they offered to naturalize foreigners who settled in the colonies for 7 years and without being absent for more than 2 months. And if you do that, you'd no longer have to swear in the good faith of a Christian. You could become a naturalized citizen, even with your Jewish faith. Why is this important? Well, it's important because if you were not a citizen, there were legal disabilities towards commercial activity and to pay special taxes, not because you were a Jew, but just because you were not a naturalized citizen. So this was economically very relevant, the Plantation Act. Why did Parliament do it? Because they wanted people to move to the colonies. Again, population, population, population. You want to grow so you can fend off the Indians and the French and all the other bad guys. Okay? And so if people are willing to take citizenship, wonderful. What did not come along with this Plantation Act was real political rights. Jews were not afforded the right to vote or to hold public office on account of this naturalization. It just meant that they had baseline economic rights. But even that was more than Jews had on the British Isles themselves. Because in 1753, the British Parliament passed the Jew Bill. Okay, the Jew Bill of 1753 would give Jews living in England naturalization after a 7 years residence. It passed, wonderful, mazel tov, simon tov, mazel tov. But what happened? There was a backlash, good old-fashioned British anti-Semitism. And in 1754, it was repealed. So for 1 year, things were good. And guess what? Gone away. And that's an important thing to remember in modern Jewish history, that emancipation is not on a trajectory going in one direction without any hiccups. Emancipation in the various parts of Europe, including the British Isles, have its ups and downs. And just because you've secured something doesn't mean you've secured it forever. Okay. What about in Jamaica? Well, interestingly, in Jamaica, anti-Jewish sentiment developed as soon as Jews were quote-unquote successful. Those successful Jews, they're making money. So discriminatory taxation was imposed there on Jews, something that was not done on the mainland colonies. So this is a very important point, that discriminatory legislation is something our people are accustomed to around the world, at least in the pre-modern period, and of course in Nazi Germany. But in mainland North America, there never were discriminatory taxes imposed upon Jews. Yes, liabilities and disability when it comes to political rights, but not discriminatory taxation. Okay. Now, we mentioned about the rabbis. And I said there was one itinerant rabbi, and he was Chaim Yitzchak Karigal. He was originally from Hebron, from the Jewish community, the old Jewish community of Hebron. And what happened? He went to Jamaica, then New York, then Philadelphia, then Newport, then Suriname, then Barbados, where he died in 1777. Ostensibly, he was collecting money for the Kehila in Hebron and for the Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael. However, he died before he could ever go back. So I don't know what happened to the money. It's like, you know, a question, where's his money? But it seems more like it that he was just a man of the world. He liked traveling. Certain people have a wanderlust. You know, they want to see the world. Who else was like that? Moses Montefiore was like that. He traveled to Israel 9 times before there was the advent of the plains. So he wanted to travel the world. Well, he was in America. He, in Newport, he came across Ezra Stiles. Who is Ezra Stiles? An important theologian who would go on to become the president of Yale. Okay? How many Jews were in Hebron in 1770? I have no idea, but I would guess it could not have been more than a few hundred. If...
I don't know, but it
could not have been more than a few hundred. So, all right. So Stiles is fascinated by Jews. He's religiously tolerant. And he thinks, wow, we have a rabbi from the land of Israel. The Holy Land, the promised land is here. So he studies with Karigal Hebrew and rabbinic literature. And Ezra Stiles, who only knew 10 letters of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet before he encountered a Jew, he studies the whole Bible, cover to cover, Genesis through Chronicles, and translates it into English, and then starts translating Rashi, too. So a fascinating man, Ezra Stiles, all because of his encounter with Jews. He went to Shul, Stiles, on Tisha B'Av in 1773 in Newport. He went to Shul on Tisha B'Av and was amazed that the Jews were praying for the restoration of the temple. Do you know how there's that old story about Napoleon goes to Shul on Tisha B'Av and sees the Jews? That's baloney. That never happened. But Ezra Stiles, he went to Shul on Tisha B'Av and said a similar thing. So they should, all the outreach to Divrei Torah was mentioned with Napoleon, replace Napoleon, put in Ezra Stiles. Now, but the truth of the matter is that in colonial America, even the nice ones like Stiles and William Penn and Roger Williams, okay, they did not believe that all religions are created equal. No. Rather, there are better ones and there are worse ones, and each one thinks his is the best, and that the Judaism, you know, rabbinical Judaism is kind of at the bottom of the heap. But despite there being better ones and worse ones, well, we should be tolerant of them all. But unlike in the old world, where there's a nastiness and a fundamentalism that can't countenance the existence of another religious group, that in America, the Americas, we're going to allow a let live and let live attitude, even as we still think our religion is superior. Okay. I want to discuss a topic that is a bit of a curious topic, that of mysticism among American Jews. So conventional wisdom has it that early American Jews were not into mysticism. Jacob Rader Marcus, who's the Gadol Hador of the of American Jewish historians from 3 generations ago, he lived to be 102, I think. He was born in 1894, died, I think, in 1998, maybe 104, was professor at Hebrew Union College, and was the first big scholar of American Jewish history. He said the following, quote, "Since there was no oppression, there was no need here to escape through emotionalism, mysticism, or ecstatic flights of imagination. The colonial Jews never illuminated their hearts by clouding their minds." How do you like that quote? If I ever saw one. It's a misnagid if I ever saw one. Basically, he's poo-pooing Hasidism, Kabbalism, everything that has anything to do with mysticism, he's saying is just shtusim, nonsense for people who are suffering from oppression. But if you live in a nice place where there's no anti-Semitism and you can live a settled existence without having to worry that you're going to be killed, so under those conditions, you can be a rationalist and not have mishagas in your religion. That's what Marcus is saying, and that's what he claims was true about American Jews in the beginning. Okay, David Sorkin, another important historian, said that the port Jews. What's a port Jew? A port Jew is a Jew who lives in a port city in the 15th, 16th, 1700s who takes on certain characteristics that are different from the old world Jews and are precursors of the modern Jews. So Sorkin says that port Jews and American colonial Jews are port Jews who displayed certain features of modern Jewry a century before the broader emancipation. Quote, reduction of Judaism to a synagogue-based religion with growing emphasis on faith as opposed to practice, immersion in the larger Christian culture, emergence of assimilation, and development of a segmental Jewish life and identity. In other words, that the Jews in America, are these port Jews, and they're interacting with Christians. They're not living a parochial Jewish life, and that their religion is now no longer the religion of the home, the yeshiva, the Beis Medrash, and the synagogue, but rather it's just the religion of the synagogue. And you're not that frum anymore, and mitzvah observance takes a steep decline. There's radical assimilation, eventually there's intermarriage. That's the characteristic of the port Jews and of colonial American Jews. So, and you live a segmental Jewish life, that a part of your life is suffused with Judaism, but the vast bulk of your existence is totally unrelated to Judaism. Okay, so Jonathan Sarna, the great historian, professor at Brandeis, disagrees with Marcus and Sorkin. He sees things differently. He notices the synagogue names. There are five shuls in colonial America. The five shuls were, in Philadelphia and Savannah, Mikveh Israel, in New York, She'erit Israel, in Newport, Yeshuat Israel, and in Charleston, Beit Elohim. So what do we see from the names of these shuls? Well, Mikveh Israel, the hope of Israel. She'erit Israel, the remnant of Israel, the surviving remnant of Israel. Yeshuat Israel, the salvation of Israel. And Beit Elohim, the house of God. So you could read into these names that the Jews of America believed in redemption, in the millennium, in an apocalypse, and that the arrival of Jews in the New World is heralding the messianic arrival. Who else believed that the dispersion of the Jews to the far corners of the earth would herald a messianic arrival? Who else believed that?
Menashe Israel.
Okay, so Menashe ben Israel may have believed that personally, but he certainly tried to convince Christians of it.
Yeah.
In good faith or in bad faith, he tried to convince Oliver Cromwell that Jews ought to be allowed into England because if you want the second coming of Jesus, which they did, you have to have the radical dispersion of Jews to the far corners of the earth, and England is the far corner of the earth. It's by Europe.
And that's where you get the wandering Jew theory.
So, right. So the wandering Jew is a historical reality, and it becomes a theological truth or a theological necessity for certain denominations of Christians. Okay, so Sana says, look at these names. They indicate that the Jews in America believed that something was up, that the messianic times are coming because of their widespread dispersion. Was Chaim Salman a practicing Jew? The answer is he was certainly an involved Jew, an affiliated Jew. I couldn't tell you whether or not he was in his private life especially observant. I don't think we really can know that, but he certainly was heavily involved in the affairs of the community. And presumably that meant that at least in public, he was observant of the Sabbath. Okay. So Menashe ben Israel, the devout Kabbalist, believed in the coming of the millennium, and he regarded the Indians, the Native Americans, as the 10 lost tribes of Israel.
Hmm.
Why did Menashe ben Israel think that the Indians were the 10 lost tribes, do you know?
Didn't they have some kind of rituals that were similar to Judaism?
So that may be true, but he didn't know that. So assuming he didn't know that, why might he say that they're the 10 lost tribes of Israel? He guesses?
Were they circumcised?
No, they were not circumcised. So if you recall, for those of you who read my essays, I wrote a number of years ago an essay titled Creationism Without Racism. Does anybody remember that essay that I wrote, Creationism Without Racism? Parshas Bereishis. Okay, and I wrote about the issue of monogenism. What is monogenism? That everybody is a descendant from one original man. one original, Adam HaRishon, Adam and Chava, that in Judaism we believe this, monogenism. So what's the problem with monogenism? Well, what happens if you find peoples who don't seem to be descended from Adam HaRishon, because their civilization is very, very ancient, and it doesn't look like they were descendants of Noah who survived the flood. So who are these people? So the Native Americans, you have two options. You can either say that, well, they're actually the 10 lost tribes that got spread out far, far away and got lost. Or you could say that they're not human beings, that they're not the descendants of Adam HaRishon, they're not the survivors of the flood of Noah, but rather that the new world didn't get flooded in the days of Noah, and these people are not really people. Now, that's a big racist thing to say, all right? But racism was popular back then. It isn't popular today. So, but for Menashe ben Israel, that was not palatable. He did not like that option. Therefore, he had no other option but to say, who are these Native Americans? The 10 lost tribes. That was what motivated him. Okay, so, Jews in the New World may have, according to Sarna, adopted this kind of apocalyptic messianic approach of Menashe ben Israel, and believed in the soon arrival of the Jewish Messiah, not the second coming of Jesus. And how do you facilitate the arrival of the Messiah? What ritual can you do to bring back the Mashiach? What can you do? If you give money to Kupat Ha'ir, what do they do for you? Anybody know? You'll get in the mail the thing from Kupat Ha'ir, from Reb Kanievsky, from Reb Eliyahu in the old days. What do they do for you from Kupat Ha'ir?
They pray for you.
Where and when?
Tisha B'Av.
Not just Tisha B'Av. And where?
In Rome, I thought.
No, at the Kotel.
Oh, at the Kotel.
For 40 days. Usually before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Chodesh Elul. And what do they do? Which prayer? Tikkun Chatzos. What is Tikkun Chatzos? So Tikkun Chatzos is when you get up in the middle of the night and you say some prayers in the middle of the night over the Churban. So only very holy people do this. I would imagine not too many members of the Young Israel of Woodmere or Scarsdale or New Rochelle or Anshe Shalom are doing Tikkun Chatzos. I'd be very surprised if anybody was. But Jews in America, some of them, were doing Tikkun Chatzos. Why? They may have believed that the Messiah is coming. Now, something else happened. Ezra Stiles reported that the Jews engaged in messianic speculation. Messianic speculation. Well, there's a pasuk in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, verse 25, that says that the Messiah will arrive, or the redemption will occur, after a time, times, and a half a time. Time, times, and half a time. So, what's the time? The time, according to the tradition, is 490 years. Why 490 years? Because it's seven times the year, seven times 70, because of the sabbatical years, the Shemitot. So, what's 490 plus 980 plus 245? 1715. When was the destruction of the temple? In the year 70. But Jews thought it was in the year 68. So if you add 68 and 1715, what do you get? 1783. That the Jews believed in the year 1783, the Mashiach was coming. Did he come?
No.
No, but America won the Revolutionary War, so that's pretty good too. You know, they made a peace treaty with England. Okay, now, Newport Jews also did something very curious that is mystical in nature. Whenever it rained, they would open the windows and the doors of the shul, and they would cry out to God on the basis of a Kabbalistic notion that when there's a storm, storm clouds up ahead, overhead, that it could be that the Messiah is coming, and you will be carried on those storm clouds back to the land of Israel. So, in fact, what happened is they flooded the basement. But it shows that they had sort of a mystical intentions about and a belief in the Messiah. Okay. Now, that's all well and good. That's Sana's theory. But I have a different theory than Sana, about the names of the shuls, a different spin on it. And what's my spin, the Hoffman approach? Well, I think these names don't necessarily indicate that they believe the Messiah was coming and there's a restoration of Zion, but rather that America is the new Zion. And not necessarily in the reform sense of rejecting Jewish nationalism. So this is not, you know, Kaufman Kohler and the worst of the reform anti-Zionists, no. But it's saying that we are here, life is good, we are optimistic about our existence here, and so we will name our synagogues in that vein. So let's go through the names. Mikveh Israel, the hope of Israel. What is the hope? The hope is that we will no longer be hounded by the Inquisition, that we can find some resting place. That is the hope of Israel, to no longer be the wandering Jew. Sherit Israel, the remnant of Israel, well, the vast bulk of the Spanish-Portuguese community either had to apostatize, whether willingly or not so willingly, or was killed, or was expelled and went to the Levant, that there are very few Jews left from that Spanish-Portuguese community, and we are the Sherit Israel, the remnant, and we found a home in America. What about Yeshuat Israel, the salvation of Israel? That America is the salvation of Israel. That Newport, that Rhode Island is the where we're going to find Menuchat HaNefesh, tranquility. And lastly, Beit Elohim. Where in the Bible do we find Beit Elohim? What Pasha?
Yaakov.
Pasha's Vayetze, Yaakov. He says,
Beit Elohim
is Eshar Shemayim. So where is that location? Well, it depends if you look in the Rashi or the Ramban, but the point is it's either Beit El or Yerushalayim. It's a holy place in the promised land. Now, to refer to your temple, your synagogue, as Beit Elohim, not in Eretz Yisrael, not in Yerushalayim or the holy places, might be an indication that what? That you think there isn't a need for the restoration of Zion, but rather that this is our new house of God, because Charleston is our home. So again, I'm not saying this is radical anti-Zionism and anti-nationalism, but it is saying that America was like a godsend to them, and they viewed it along the lines of the promised land. Okay, now we have 10 minutes left. Let's just cover a few more points. Colonial Jewry emphasized voluntary conformity to communal standards. Now, voluntary because there's no law of the land that requires you to adhere to the tenets of the faith, to keep kosher, to put tefillin every morning. The government isn't forcing you, and the community can't force you. But they would like you to play by the traditional rules. So it's a spirit of voluntarism. Now, there's a story about a threat of excommunication in Sheretz Yisrael on Yom Kippur, that in the 1750s, they announced so-and-so was eating treif, or was doing business on Shabbos, and if he doesn't shape up, he won't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That was a big threat, the no cemetery business. And so the threat worked. The guy fell into line. But sometimes the threat of being ousted from this voluntary community was enough to get people to change their behavior. Now, the Ashkenazim tended to criticize the Sephardim for being lax in their religious observance. And this was true. The Sephardim, who on the whole were more acculturated and possibly also wealthier, were a little bit more indifferent to the minutiae of religious law. And the Ashkenazim didn't like that. So why don't the Ashkenazim break away and form their own shul? Well, they will in due time, but they can't just yet because there's not a critical mass of Ashkenazim to counter the Sephardim. Only in 1795 will you have the first breakaway synagogue. You'll have it in Philadelphia where the Ashkenazim form Rodev Shalom, and then in New York in 1825 when the Ashkenazim form Bnei Yeshurun. So the Ashkenazim complain the Sephardim aren't firm enough. What about Ashkenazim and Sephardim mixing for matrimonial purposes? You know, Tu B'Av is the holiday of Jewish unity. Tu B'Av, Jewish unity. Everybody can, you know, marry each other. Yisachar can marry Zevulun and so on and so forth. So did Ashkenazim marry Sephardim? And the answer is they didn't at first, but by the 1730s and 40s, it was becoming increasingly popular. Gershom Mendes Seishas, who becomes the Chazan of Sherith Israel in New York from 1765 until his death in 1816 at a long tenure, he was a product of a mixed marriage. His father was a Mendes Seishas, was a Sephardi, and his mother was Rachel Levy, an Ashkenazi. So if there was any stigma to marrying beneath your caste, for a prestigious Spanish-Portuguese Jew to marry a lowly Ashkenazic German Jew, yeah, for a while it was like an embarrassment, a busha, a cherpa, you know, a shanda. But after a while, it was no shanda. Okay. We spoke about kosher meat. Ah, what else did the community do aside from the kosher meat and synagogue services? The answer is it provided schooling for the children, both in Hebrew and in English education. Because remember, there's no public schools. There's no secular or non-denominational schools yet. If you want your kid to learn anything and you don't want it under the auspices of some other religion, you got to go to the Jewish school. And lastly, they provided charity for the poor on the premise that Jews have to take care of their own. Like we said last week, you know, in the days of Peter Stuyvesant, that he accused the Jews of becoming a public charge. So the condition of Jewish presence in America, North America, is you don't rely on us for tzedakah. You rely on your own people for tzedakah. Okay. Now, there was a problem in the 18th century in the communities. And that was that the members of the community were very reluctant to serve as leaders, as the parnas, or as an assistant parnas. But why was this true? So it's attributable to the fact that it was a time-consuming job with a lot of responsibilities to run the kahila. Nobody wanted to have to impose sanctions for non-compliance on a family member, a personal friend, a business partner. These were very small communities. What if I'm the Parnas and my brother is Mechal Shabbos, or my business partner was caught eating treif? So there was a question, were there Moalim? The answer is yes, there were Moalim. Not in every city, but there were Moalim. Was there migration from Curacao to Charleston? The answer to that is yes. There was migration from Curacao to Charleston and to Newport and to a lesser extent to New York. Okay, so So people did not want to take the job of the Parnas because you really would have to impose punishment, sanction on people who you knew in your personal life. It was such a small community, nobody wants to do that. The authority of the synagogue community supposedly extended to all Jews in the region, whether they liked it or not, European style. Meaning if you're a Jew and you live in the vicinity of New York, then Sheirith Israel is your boss for all religious matters. You were forbidden to establish a breakaway or a second minion. You couldn't do it. You had to play by the rules of the major kahila. But the problem is, such pretensions of hegemony were dubious in the American colonies. I'll give you an example, a simple example. Sheirith Israel in Lower Manhattan could not easily compel the remittance of taxes or compliance in Jewish law by an isolated Jew living in Westchester or Long Island. Okay, a random Chaim Yankel who lives in New Rochelle, and by the way, there was a first Jew in New Rochelle in 1732. Okay, if the Jew in New Rochelle is doing his business on Main Street on Shabbos, how is Sheirith Israel going to punish that guy? He doesn't care, he's not going to pay the tax. Or if he's out on Long Island somewhere, how does Sheirith Israel boss him around? They can't. So whereas in Europe, you had the long arm of the law, in America, there's no arm of the law. The colonies did not compel the existence of a kehillah. In pre-modern Europe, the Jewish community was a corporate body recognized by the state, and it was an intermediary between the Jewish residents, not citizens, but residents, and the state itself. So, but in the colonies, that corporate body as a conduit between residents, Jews, and the state does not exist. It will never exist. Because it doesn't exist, the actual kehila, the synagogue, doesn't have enforcement power. Only insofar as Jews want to be part of the community, don't want to be buried in a goyish cemetery, don't want to be denied an aliyah in the shul, then they'll comply. Okay. Now, the position and influence had once been a counterbalancing factor to the time-consuming burdens of leadership. Meaning it used to be, you didn't want to be upon us. But maybe you did, because although it's a hard job, you get a lot of covered, and you could boss people around, and you could be a big shot, a macher. So you're willing to take on the burdens of shul life in order to be a macher. You know people like that today. Well, in the ancient world, or the pre-modern world, that was a trade-off that existed, and some people went for it. But in colonial America, there really was no longer a trade-off. You had the burdens of leadership, but you didn't have influence and power. Because after all, How could you lord over the other person? The Kehila doesn't have a corporate existence anymore. All you could do is say, oh, you want a Chamishi on Yom Kippur? You're not going to get it. Your enemy is going to get it. I mean, baloney. That's not exactly a real threat. So because the power and influence was waning, therefore the desirability of the job of Parnas and synagogue president was on the decline. Okay, to sum it up, last point for tonight, the shift to the voluntary association was made necessary by the social and political reality of the colonies and would continue along those lines after the American Revolution in 1776. It led to the utter demise of the Jewish community. But the Jewish community, where there were sufficient numbers, successfully transitioned from the corporate body notion of Jewish life to the voluntaristic association. The danger, of course, is if there are too many breakaways and too much of a fissure in communal life, and the only solution to that fissure is let there be enough people, enough Jews present to justify the emergence of competing institutions. Well, in some communities, you'll have that. In the major cities, you won't. And where you don't have that, but nonetheless there is division, you end up having the death of the Jewish community locally. So we'll stop here. And next time, we're going to discuss the Revolutionary War and how that impacted the various communities. Some people were patriots supporting the revolution, and some people were loyal to the crown, to George III. Is there any rhyme or reason to why some people pick this side versus that side? Yes. Sometimes it has to do with the economy, and sometimes it has to do with just basic ideology of the notions of freedom. Okay, but Jews play a significant and outsized role in the Revolutionary War, given that they were only 0.1% of the overall population. So see you all next week. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Really, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.